This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
John, are you recording?
I am recording,
okay,
Andy.
Okay, come on.
Yay.
Right.
We have liftoff. Let's do this.
Let's go.
Let's go. I've got a drink. I've got my notes. I've got some books. Hello, Samantha. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, Andy.
Hi.
Where are you calling us from this evening?
I am in North London, like every Jewish girl should be. And I have just done my Friday night candles on Zoom. Oh. And all ready to talk about Ross.
Kieran, where are you?
I'm in Norwich, Andy. The fine city of Norwich, Norfolk.
I know you're in Norwich. I dream of seeing Norwich again one day.
Oh, one day that dream will come true, Andy. I promise you.
I hope so.
If you hope and pray.
And how has Norwich responded to events of the last year?
Well, if Norwich was quiet to start with, it's kind of descended into silence, really. I have tried to see it as an opportunity to enjoy the city where I live all the more, and its many virtues and its history and its beautiful architecture and all of these things. And frankly, I am busting to get out.
Yeah, and then what did you do in week two?
Yeah, exactly.
John, shall we begin?
Let's do it, shall we? Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today you find us in a small town on the Russian border in the early 20th century, eating bowls of warm soup with a small Jewish family living in a single room, the floor scrubbed so clean it shines like melted sunshine, the tallow from the cheap candles dripping on the Czech tablecloth. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund books they really want to read.
I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And today we are joined by a new guest, Kieran Pym, and a returning guest, Samantha Ellis. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Samantha joined us on our eighth ever episode 5 years ago to discuss Lolly Willows by Sylvia Townsend Warner. And then it took her 4 years to crawl her way back onto the show for episode 94 when she joined us to talk about The Prince of West End Avenue by Alan Eisler, and both, may we say, terrific novels and terrific
amazing books
episodes. So thanks for coming back for a third time, Sam.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Kieran Pym is an author, freelance journalist and creative writing tutor whose last book was Jumpin' Jack Flash, David Litvinoff and the Rock and Roll Underworld. I'm going to say that again so listeners can get a pen and write down the title of that book if they haven't read it, because it is sensational. Jumpin' Jack Flash, David Litvinoff and the Rock and Roll Underworld by Kieran Pym. So, Kieran, thanks for coming in just on that basis alone. That book is the first biography of one of the most extraordinary characters in 60s London, published by Jonathan Cape in 2016. Previously, Kieran wrote a popular science book about dinosaurs and edited and introduced Into the Light, the medieval Hebrew poetry of Mir of Norwich. Wow. The first translated edition of poems by a 13th century writer from the city where Kieran lives. That is range, Kieran, if you don't mind me saying.
I like to think that they all have something in common about digging things up from the past, possibly.
Oh, I like how I rationalise it.
But yeah, it's been a kind of a curious literary career to date that's involved a fair bit of leaping around.
Kieran is attempting to balance the homeschooling requirements of three daughters in lockdown with writing the first English language biography of Joseph Roth. That's a coincidence.
Whoa, what? No one warned me about that.
I wondered what I was doing here.
Huge, if true. And it's scheduled to be published by Granta in autumn 2022. And so very quickly, before we introduce Samantha, clear up. There's a pint resting on this, Kieran. How do you pronounce Joseph Roth?
Okay. I think we can say Joseph Roth. However, a great many of the scholars and enthusiasts for his writing who I've spoken to in the last few years have pronounced his surname as he would have done, which is Rolt, or if you want to be really Germanic about it, with a kind of rolled R, Rolt. Either Joseph Rolt or Joseph Rolt.
Joseph Roth.
I think we can go for Joseph Roth.
I think we can go for Roth. Yes.
Yeah, like he's Phil's brother, you know?
That's fine. I heard Matthew Paris grumpily introduce an episode of Great Lives about Rafe Vaughan Williams by saying, the researchers have told me I have to say Rafe, but I'm not going to. It's Ralph Vaughan Williams. So we're taking a leaf out of his book and we're saying Joseph Roth. Thank you very much. We're also joined by Samantha Ellis. Samantha is the author of a brilliant reading memoir, How to Be a Heroine, or What I've Learned from Reading Too Much, and a biography of Anne Bronte, which we talked about, I think I talked about on here, actually, which is also wonderful, called Take Courage. She also writes plays, including How to Date a Feminist, which has been produced in London, Gdansk, Mexico City, Istanbul, and in several theatres in Germany, in one of which it was staged in a boxing room. But put all those achievements aside and hold on to your hats, everybody, because Samantha also worked on both Paddington films.
No higher praise.
In a fairly minor way, but, you know.
can you give us one thing that you contributed to the Paddington universe?
Well, I think it was... I think I was brought in partly because my parents are refugees from Baghdad, and I think we were looking at the refugee storyline, which Michael Bond does so brilliantly, but obviously needed more of it for 90 minutes of film. So I didn't do all of it by any stretch of the imagination, but I did sit around talking quite a lot about refugees and Paddington not being welcome and how he would try and fit in. And I still find just reading the book with my son tonight is so moving. Little bear arriving, yeah. And not irrelevant to tonight either. The themes of exile,
indeed,
and
absolutely
loss.
So we've got the biographer of Joseph Roth here, but Samantha, what are your bona fides for attending this evening?
Wrote a play several years ago for a drama school, Lambda, in London, which was about Joseph Roth's life and also about his novel The String of Pearls, sometimes translated as The Tale of a Thousand Second Nights. There was no biography for me to read at that point, so I guessed quite a lot. So I'm very keen to read Kieran's biography because I think probably about 80% of the guesses are wrong. So I had to do a lot of rewriting.
In your version, did Joseph Roth come from Peru and like marmalade sandwiches?
That was key to my version, yeah. Okay. Is that correct, Kieran?
It's not how I understand it, but I haven't finished my research yet.
History is interpretation, everybody, isn't it?
It is.
John, over to you.
The book, of course, that we're here to talk about, in case you hadn't already guessed, is by Joseph Roth, Job, The Story of a Simple Man, first published in 1930. And that book will be our focus, but in customary backlisted fashion, we'll cover other books by Roth in the course of our discussion.
But before we head back into Central Europe to test the mettle of our faith, John, what have you been reading this week?
So the book I've been reading is The Death of Francis Bacon by Max Porter. Max Porter, author of Grief is a Thing with Feathers, and Lanny. And I think we can officially say a friend of Backlisted. He did two amazing Backlisted, one on Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, live at the Port Elliot Festival, but also one before that on The Horse's Mouth by Joyce Carey, about a painter, Gully Jimson. And this new book is also about a painter. Mm-hmm. It's about the great British artist of the mid to late 20th century, Francis Bacon, and very specifically about his last days. He is dying, lying on a bed, dying in a hospital in Madrid, a hospital run by nuns, being attended to by one particular nun, Sister Mercedes. And what is it? Well, it's a Max Porter book, so it isn't easily classifiable. It certainly isn't a straightforward novel. It certainly isn't a straightforward book of poetry, but it has elements of both. It is divided into seven short sections, each one a painting, an untitled Francis Bacon painting, or an untitled Max Porter version of a Francis Bacon painting. And a best way to kind of characterise it, I suppose, is Bacon is... He dies of a heart attack, but his asthma, his respiratory condition is very, very bad. And he is ebbing in and out of consciousness in a liminal state, remembering episodes, flashing episodes from his life in and out, as I say, in seven quite discrete sections. It's also, I suppose, a meditation. It certainly isn't art criticism or art history. Max himself has said that it was an attempt to write as if he were painting rather than about painting. And indeed, he appears in the narrative at least at one point asking Francis Bacon questions. For people who like Max's work, I would say perhaps if you imagine the style that he, I think, kind of develops, the impressionistic, very, very dense language that he perfected with the dead Papa Toothwort sections of Lanny. It's like seven of those. So quite a short book, incredibly evocative and also fascinating. I mean,
it sounds like the polar opposite of Unquiet Landscape by Christopher Neave, which is the book that I talked about last time.
Yes. I guess we all have bits and pieces of Francis Bacon lore stored away, you know, those extraordinary visceral canvases. You know, Bacon, we know about the squalor of his studio. We know about the terrible sort of sadomasic relationships he had with younger men like George Dyer. We know about the struggles he had to get his paintings. Eventually, they were perhaps valued at the right level, but he, like a lot of painters, he was ripped off earlier in his career. We know about the famous drinking at the Colony Rooms. All of that is there, that kind of sense of louche 50s Soho, 60s Soho is there. But there's also, as I say, a really interesting attempt to translate, almost synesthetic attempt to translate the moving of colour on canvas into words. And, you know, painting is there in front of you. It isn't trying to mount an argument. It isn't trying necessarily to tell a story. That stuff we kind of project onto it. So it's not going to be an easy book for people to grapple with necessarily, and that's a good thing. You know, this is a book I will read, I think, again and again. It's a book that sent me back enthusiastically to the paintings. It's maybe not, Francis Bacon might not be the painter that you would have assumed Max Porter in his Lanny mode, his sort of deep English kind of green man mode might have chosen. But he's been obsessed with Francis Bacon's work since he was a child. And that obsession, I think, has been borne out by this, I think, really, really remarkable bit of work. He says something which I love. He says something he wants to capture the stink of Bacon's life, the sort of shocking, visceral stink, turpentine, he says, oil, fags, cologne, breath mints. Well, I think he achieves it. And the best way, I think, maybe to witness it is to listen to Max himself, a brilliant reader of his own and other people's work. But here is a section of Max reading from the second of the seven kind of paintings in the sequence.
Take a seat, why don't you? But I'm still asleep, so she doesn't hear. Nice familiar weight at the foot of the bed. the sort of fever guest wait, aunt or mother, nurse, or the after-fuck check-up to tuck me in, still a little whiff of hurt in the room, of procedures. Rather wonderful, actually, to be reminded of childhood sickness and post-coital exhaustion in the same second. Rather comforting. Close. Take a seat, why don't you? I heard you before, Piggy. Process. Grouse. A throwaway remark to a journalist. Twee my bloody tombstone. Quail, red currant jus, oysters, the pheasant stew I tried to do after we had it at the claustrophobic place when I bit down on shot. It's extraordinarily nice not to have to order or get up. It all just arrives when I think of it and somewhat offsets the embarrassment of Capello lying a mile from here when I suppose I always thought one might be murdered, have one's throat slit, or be garrotted in an alley off Frith Street. Not comic. Vultures. Bit down on shot and regretted saying anything about accidents. I can still feel it right through me, like a shock. Metal drill in my fillings, right down through my urethra, buzzing in my underbladder. Edward the Martyr or Francis the Painter? Oh, hello, ducky. You look like a pastry. A slightly overdone bun. I would have you twisting to look over your shoulder, cap on, uniformed, slight formless gash where your crowded mouth is, that lovely brow like a Minotaur's shoulder in the middle. Good face. Do you know the poem Picasso wrote about Guernica? I was terribly, terribly struck by it. Cries of children. Cries of women. Cries of birds. Do you know it? He says, I think, something like, cries of the stew in the pot. Can you imagine? Scorched earth and little button mushrooms, thyme, shallots, manzanilla. I suppose something dry, all sticky in the Le Creuset. I say, bloody bring it out here. Don't bother plating it up. We'll eat from the casserole, won't we, darling? Just bread and more wine. I think that will do splendidly. Look at that. May all who see thee bless the great creator who made so fair a thing. Quite right. Quite right. Sante.
Sold.
Read it. It's if you like bacon and you like Max Porter, you will not be disappointed. Andy, what have you been reading?
I've been reading the first novel by our former guest, Selina Godden, which is called Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death. Selina was our guest on the episode that we made about Last Exit to Brooklyn by Hubert Selby Jr. And it is, with all due respect to any guests who are here today, one of my favourite moments we've ever had on Backlisted was when Selina read from Last Exit to Brooklyn, and as she read, the hairs on my arms went up, and I can remember looking at our then producer, Matt, and it's the first time that I ever did this, I've talked about looking at him saying, this is recording, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It was one of those electrical things in the room that I just thought, if we've recorded this, this is going to be the most incredible thing. And indeed, all these years later, whenever people listen to that episode, that's one of the things that, they contact Backlisted about and say, wow, I couldn't believe that. So I'm very specifically talking about Selina's novel, not just her novel, the audiobook of her novel. The subject of the novel is death, and death is a woman. Death has been spending eternity doing her job, but she's getting tired. She decides she wants to rest, and she chooses a young man called Wolf Williford to take down her memoirs. And around that, Selina weaves a really fascinating mixture of poetry, prose, and performance. And if you want to understand how all those things mesh together, I think it's really the audiobook that you have to go to. Alan Moore, the great Alan Moore, compares this novel to Richard Brautigan. And before I'd read it, I thought, oh, come off it, Alan Moore, the great Alan Moore. It's not going to be anything like Brautigan. Do you know what? It is really like Richard Brautigan or Hubert Selby Jr. Knowing that Selina loves that countercultural, left field, experimental writing, and seeing it come through her work and her voice in whatever sense you want to use that, it's really exciting. A bit like Max's book, I didn't understand all of it, but I like books that I don't understand all of, because they keep you guessing and they keep surprising you. So I'd like to play a bit now of Selina Godden's reading from Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death. And I chose a section that really affected me the first time I heard it, because it seemed very relevant to where we are in 2021.
This is that rainy day. It is raining here and it is raining now. Look at the news. Read any newspaper. Listen to the radio. Watch your TV. Here I come. Death is coming for us all. And when I come and I clean up. Death cleans up. Death takes all the glory. Death gets the last word. People will say, you died. That's it. And that is all. That's the punchline. They will say your name and shake their heads and sigh. You are dead. Bowie, dead. Prince, dead. They'll see a photograph of you and say the word, dead, gone, past tense, done and dusted. But your spirit lives on. It enters the room now as I say this. It enters the room every time someone remembers you and says your name. All of my dead are here, in this room now, as I speak. I can feel them as I write this and think of their names. It's pretty crowded in here right now, because I know a lot of dead people now. You know a lot of dead people now. We know a lot of dead people now. We all know a lot of dead people. And it hurts to erase you. I cannot seem to do it. My phone is filled with dead people. I never unfriend my dead people, brilliant and vibrant and colourful people who are now bone and stone cold dead, people who aren't even here to see what you became, to see what they left behind, to see plump pink children stamping on sandcastles, killing and consuming everything, to see the death of the demanding chubby shit you were. And the birth of the kind, wise person you will become. To see the photographs and share the memories. To gasp at how fat you got or how bald you are. How you wear spectacles now. Your laughter lines. The laughs and the love, love. The love. The love. The love. That's the stuff, darling. The love. Love. The love. The love, love. That's what living was always about.
Wow.
Right?
She read that last night. I went to her gig at the Idler last night. Obviously went, you know, in heavy inverted commas. She read that piece. It's just, it's stunning, isn't it?
We'll be back in just a sec.
The Horrigan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Horrigan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Horrigan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quite a big key change there.
I'm on it, Nick. I'm on it.
Well, how do you follow Selena Godden reading
so brilliantly from Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death. You get the Soviet State Military Orchestra to play to play the Radetzky March for you. Yes, that was the Radetzky March by Strauss. The Radetzky March is, of course, probably Joseph Roth's most famous novel. And during the show today, we're going to hear other renditions of the Radetzky March from a variety of sources. So eyes down, get your bingo cards out for that. We're not talking about the Radetzky March today. We're talking about Job, a different novel written 3 years earlier, 3 or 4 years earlier. Yeah.
Two
years earlier, says the biographer Joseph Roth, Kieran Pym. But before we actually start talking about Job, I feel as though John and I both feel that Roth is, in a sense, one of the most challenging authors we've ever talked about on Backlisted, because no one book seems to encapsulate all the things that he's about. So before we start talking about that, let's ask the traditional Backlisted question. Kieran, I'll ask you first as the biographer. When did you first read Joseph Roth?
I can be quite precise about that. 2002, when Granter published Michael Hoffman's translation of The Wandering Jews, which my cousin read and recommended to me. He thought it'd be right up my streets, and I read it and I thought it was wonderful. And so he was always an author after that who was there in the back of my mind. But I didn't go on to read him for quite some time after that. But then when I was writing my last book, the David Litvinov book, I started thinking about him again then. I read a little book about him by Dennis Marks, which is just called Wandering Jew, which is just a little study, a kind of psychogeographic study of Dennis Marks' attempts to try to piece together Roth's story. And that kind of whetted my appetite a little bit more as well. I think I quoted that book briefly and some of Roth's The Wandering Jews in the Litvinov book, and it kind of just brought him back up to the surface of my mind again. And so when I was looking for a new subject after that last book, I was kind of Googling Roth around, and then I realized that there wasn't a biography, or there isn't an English language biography, at least. So I started really reading him again properly then. And I went to Radetzky March first, and then I went to Job after that. And it's kind of gone from there, really.
Samantha, when did you first read Job or Joseph Roth, or encounter or hear the name Joseph Roth?
I was working at the sadly now closed Joseph's bookstore in Temple Fortune, and we had a whole shelf of Roth that was getting added to because Michael Hoffman was translating them at this kind of rate of knots, and they were sort of coming in. And I was reading lots of books about exile and refugees, really to make sense of where, well, not where my family had come from, but what they had been through coming from Baghdad. Their experience is obviously very different, but I just had a whole thing where all I did was read about refugees for a very long time, and about exile and about loss. And I don't remember which Roth I read first, but no, I think it was the Radetzky March. And then I just kept going. And they used to kind of laugh at me because I only worked one day a week, and I would come in each week. I'd get paid at the end of the day. I'd buy a new Roth book. I'd go home. I'd come in again. And then I was like, I'd run out. I was like, come on, Michael Hoffman, you need to translate some more. And then I got the opportunity to do this play. I talked to everyone. I couldn't believe no one else was reading him. And we did a week's workshop with these drama students on the idea. And then they all got given a copy of the book. And then I came in again. And they all hated it. Like 25 of them, and they were gloomy because they were going to have to spend a year working on this text and they're like, why did you choose it? What were you thinking? What do you see in him? And it was not a happy moment, but I had to say it was useful because I did have to think about your question, actually, Andy, why is it so challenging? Like, those are 25 intelligent, interested, you know, creative people. Yeah.
It's interesting.
There's never been a book on Backlisted that we've debated between us which book we were going to do
more
than we debated which Joseph Roth book we were going to do. And and listeners, what we decided is that we'd lead with Job, but we're also going to talk a bit about The Radetzky March, which is probably his most famous book, and The Legend of the Holy Drinker, because... that's one well known, I would say, in Britain and America, and is also very short and written at the end of his life. It seems to me, from our perspective, that Joseph Roth was much more obscure in general terms 25 years ago than he is now. And that, do you feel as though he's had a real revival, partly down to Michael Hoffman's tireless work on his behalf?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. He was, I mean, 25 years ago, you know, when I was sort of publishing, bookselling, I don't think he would have occurred at all to me as a great European writer. I just wasn't aware of him at all. That's, you know, maybe my, but I think Hoffman's translations, Granta's publishing of the work has changed that to a large degree. Until we did the podcast, the only Roth I'd read was The Legend of the Holy Drinker, which is a book that I love because it seems to me to be him at his best. It's beautifully written. It's short. And he has this remarkable ability, I think, in all his books to write very, very clearly about very big and complicated subjects in a way that makes them quite resonant. I think his star is still in the ascendant, but I still think he's a writer that people have heard of rather than read in a lot of cases.
Kieran, could you just say briefly why Job was the book that you came up with, that you felt we could usefully lead with? What is it about Job that listeners, if they were going to read a book by Joseph Roth, they should read Job rather than one of the others?
Okay, I think it's the richness and beauty, kind of sad beauty of the prose. I think it's the satisfaction of the plot. His plots are not always, shall we say, that satisfying. Sometimes you can tell that Roth has possibly got slightly bored at some point and drifted somewhat from the original premise to something that interests him more halfway through. I think Job is far more disciplined. It is one of the few of his works that leaves you with a feeling of hope.
Although, I don't know how to get to that feeling.
Yeah.
Don't worry, listeners. It drags you through some sensational misery and bleakness, which is why I liked it so much.
I did think, actually, Andy, about three quarters of the way through, I thought, ooh, Andy's going to love this.
I did. The unrelenting punch-in-the-face misery of it was very much my cup of tea. I agree with what Kieran was saying. This is from Michael Hoffman's introduction to The String of Pearls. Michael Hoffman, who was such a great guide to us, coincidentally, on our Rosemary Tonks episode last month. Michael Hoffman has basically got three careers running simultaneously. He's a poet, he's a translator, and he's a translator of Joseph Roth. And he would see himself in those terms. He feels that he's given over a great chunk of his life, soul and career, all those things, to Joseph Roth. I'd just like to read this. This is Hoffman's brief exploration of the puzzle of Joseph Roth. It's rare for an author to make such multiple, almost contradictory claims on us as the Austrian novelist Joseph Roth, 1894 to 1939. As a chronicler of the Jazz Age, you can set him alongside Scott Fitzgerald. With Malcolm Lowry, he is one of the great poets of alcoholic decline. And his work brings back the vanished world of Jewish culture in Central Europe, as much as that of the photographer Roman Vishniak. His memorial to the dual monarchy, the Empire of Austria and the Kingdom of Hungary, spread over many sad and adoring novels, is a wonderful compliment to Musil's monumental comedy, The Man Without Qualities. Roth is a novelist of exile and of personal destiny and responsibility, a French-influenced fabulist Stendhal in some versions, Proust in others, and the prose heir to Heine, a poet of Stimmungen, of public pomps and private melancholy, but a writer of plots as much as anyone this century. Each one of Roth's 13 novels, doubles and triples, presents aspects of two or more of the above, like a domino or a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. The reach and the fullness of these books, which are rarely long and never dense or heavy, is quite extraordinary. They seem to defy literary physics. The barriers between the books come to seem just about the least satisfactory thing about them. And then elsewhere he says, yes, the books are probably spoiled by being rushed, but there is in each of them more of worth than in most other books. Who actually, besides, wants to exist on a diet only of masterpieces? More seriously, I would argue that in a sense, they were never properly separated out, that in them, Roth's numerous fables are complected together, rather like a Rubik's Cube. Over many books, you will learn about father worship and father neglect, the Eastern Jew and the Austrian officer, exile, alcohol, the man disappointed by women and the conservative holdout. The sum of the books coheres more than any individual novel. Now, I can see literally everyone on my screen is nodding. Silently nodding. The sum of the books coheres more than any individual novel. Samantha, has that been your experience of reading Joseph Roth?
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, I think it's a little bit like Shakespeare. I mean, you get something from reading Pericles. It's not the perfect work, is it, that Hamlet is? It's not got the structural beauty. But you couldn't have one without the other. I mean, there are Roth books that I'm not necessarily desperate to read again, but I'm sort of glad that I have been on the journey with him, because I think it's a journey of his life that he went through quite a lot. And I think a lot of authors wouldn't necessarily put that into their books. And what I like about it is that it's all in there, I think.
Certainly the more you read, the richer the world becomes that you enter through his work. They're all like different angles into his this kind of fabulistic world that he creates, and with every book it does become richer, it becomes stranger and more beautiful, and there's a certain quality to his prose, a kind of dreamlike quality. It's a real strangeness that once you're in there, it does something very odd to you, and that I can't think of any other writer who has quite that effect on the reader. So really, yes, I think the more of his books you read, the more you become hooked.
Isn't it part of the thing about him is that he is incredibly difficult to place in terms... You feel a lot of the time this could be being written in the 1860s rather than the 1930s. He's so different. And this is actually something that Hoffman says in his introduction to the Radetzky March. His books aren't about consciousness. He says this brilliant thing. He says, you know, in the way that Proust or Faulkner or Joyce or a lot of the great kind of middle century kind of modernist writers are about, you know, expanding. They're about less and less, and consciousness expanding more and more. He says that his books, Roth's novels, are about blatant and undeniable big things, at the most attended and lit by detail. Roth's novels and stories always depict the great turnings of a life: loss, love, honour, career, betrayal, frustration, death. And I love what you say, Kieran, about the slightly otherworldly nature. But he's the most, when you read his letters and you look at his journalism, he's the most worldly writer. I mean, he's extraordinary. He's a proper jobbing journalist.
Yep.
You know,
That's a really good point, actually. And he's so... One of the things I found in trying to write this book about him is he's so hard to pin down, because whenever you think you've pinned him down one way, then you think, well, hang on, though, I've got this instance of him being absolutely the opposite of that as well.
James Woods says about him, the literary critic James Woods says about him, it's like he learnt the lessons of modernism and then somehow managed to travel back in time to the 19th century and put them into the 19th century novel, which I thought was incredibly perceptive in terms of that they have those kind of ballrooms and and agricultural and scenes meals. You'd expect really in Tolstoy.
Amazing meals.
And meals, but they're totally, they're visited by a whole other sensibility than we might used to be. So, Samantha, in a sec, you're going to read us the beginning of Job. But I think because of this thing about Roth being so hard to pin down, and we're so fortunate to have his biographer here, who's, as he said to me, I've just written 100,000 words about this and you expect me to do it in 2 minutes. I do, Kieran. I've got a little clock on
ticking,
here.
Kieran.
The clock is ticking. So could you give us a quick biographical sketch of the life of Joseph Roth?
Okay, this is a real whistle-stop tour, and I think I've got it down to about 2 minutes, but I will do my best. Okay, so Joseph Roth, writer who wrote over a dozen novels and novellas, several works of non-fiction, thousands of wonderful newspaper articles, not straight news reports, but feuilletons, poetic and personal reflections on his travels and the politics of his time, most of them published in the Frankfurter Zeitung newspaper in the 1920s and 30s. He was raised by his mother. He never knew his father, who went mad before he was born. This was the first great loss of a life that was shaped by a staggering series of losses and blows. The second defining loss was that of the Habsburg monarchy that he grew up under, which collapsed at the end of the First World War. He's been described as the great elegist of the cosmopolitan, tolerant and doomed Central European culture that flourished in the dying days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the book that most notably elegizes it is the Radetzky March. So he's a man who lost his father, then his fatherland. He was born Moses Joseph Roth in a predominantly Jewish town called Brody, which lay on the eastern edge of the empire. Back then it was part of Galicia, now it's in Ukraine. I went there a couple of years ago. Maybe we'll come back to that. He left Brody as soon as he could, first for university in Lemberg, then he transferred his studies to Vienna. Then they were disrupted by the First World War coming along. He served in the war, having initially been a pacifist, then he volunteered. He spent much of the 1920s in Vienna, Paris, and Berlin. Those were his bases anyway, but he was in perpetual motion, travelling around Europe, filing dispatches from the south of France, Rome, Albania, Russia, Poland, all over Germany. It was a frenetic, exhausting lifestyle, but I think he'd have been bored to death by anything else. By the turn of the decade, he was one of the best paid journalists in Europe, and yet he was perpetually broke for various reasons. One, he was by then a heavy drinker. Two, having grown up in near poverty, he developed quite a taste for fine living and liked to stay in the very finest hotels. Three, he was immensely generous, and even when he was broke and catching money off rich friends like Stefan Zweig, he'd then go on to share it out among his other equally hard-up friends. And four, most poignantly, his wife, Friederike, or Friedel, as she was known, succumbs to schizophrenia, and he had to work incessantly to raise the money to cover her expensive psychiatric care. Now, that feeds into Job in a way that we may talk a little bit about later. So then, 1933, Hitler takes power. Roth leaves Berlin for the final time, and he made Paris his home for the last 6 years of his life, a life drastically shortened by his alcoholism. He died a horrible alcoholic's death in a Parisian pauper's hospital in May 1939. Some of his friends felt he needn't have died then if he'd received better care, but really perhaps it was better that he didn't live to see what the next 5 years would bring for Jewish Europe, which surely would have finished him off anyway, one way or the other. So does that come in at 2 minutes? Was that?
A round of applause, please, for our friend. Congratulations, Kieran. You successfully triggered Phil Kelsall playing the Wurlitzer organ at the Tower Ballroom, Blackpool.
Is that what happens when it gets really bleak?
Yes.
Suddenly the Deputy March jumps in.
I prepped. Whenever I think things are getting too grim, up will pop the Radetzky March to bounce us along. That was Kieran. But the point is, the thing about Joseph Roth is, before he starts writing his 13 or more novels, he's already created hundreds of thousands of words of journalism.
Yes,
and he's one of the most successful journalists of his day, the 1920s, is reputedly made a Deutschmark a line, is the famous thing about him. So he's made it. He's made it. He doesn't need to then create this decade of penury and artistic struggle, but that's what he has to do.
Yes, this is it. It's not like he was underpaid, really. You know, it's not that he had poverty kind of forced upon him by his profession as a writer. Given different circumstances and given different proclivities, I suppose, he would have possibly lived a very comfortable life. But rather like Job in the Bible, he was dealt one affliction after another, and his expenses kept racking up, and it just became worse and worse, really. I mean, it's extraordinary when you look at his life. Sometimes you think there's almost a kind of bleak humour. It's almost bleakly funny, because every time you think things can't get worse, then they get worse. But obviously it wasn't funny, because it was real, and it certainly wasn't funny to him.
Samantha, is suffering seems to me to be one of the things that the novels of his that I've read, they have in common as a theme, presumably because it was never far from his mind while he was writing them.
I think so, but also I think disillusionment is almost more than suffering. You know, it's sort of beliefs, and then beliefs that you have to let go painfully. And sometimes they're religious beliefs, sometimes they're beliefs in, you know, empire, in a fatherland, in a father, in a marriage. I mean, the story of him and his wife is in everything that he writes, I think. You know, it's absolutely devastating. He marries this lovely woman. She develops schizophrenia. He has to end, you know, they're living in and out of hotel rooms, which is probably not a great thing if you don't have great mental health. You know, there's no stability. She gets madder and madder and unhappier and unhappier. He has to institutionalize her. And, you know, I mean, he didn't live to find out that she was killed as part of the euthanasia program by the Nazis, but he might have known that was where it was going, and he had to leave her, you know, and go to Paris on his own. And it just, you know, I don't know what it sort of does to you to believe in someone and think you're going to spend the rest of your life with them, and then to find that they can't do it, and also that you are going to have to fail them. He did, as Kieran said, I mean, pay for medical treatment, and you know, he did a lot. He did everything he could, but he wasn't able to be with her and look after her in the way that she needed.
This piling on of sorrow, that's kind of the plot of Job, without giving all of it away. I mean, you know, based on the biblical sort of story of Job. The thing that really fascinates me is that in this book in particular, and maybe also it's there in The Legend of the Holy Drinker and various degrees in Radetzky March. I mean, Mendel Singer, the main character in who is a simple man, an unremarkable Jew, as he describes it. It's not like hubris, is it? It's not like he does bad things. These sorrows mount on him. I don't think I've read anyone who quite catches that sense of a sort of enigmatic fable as well as Roth. He doesn't feel to me like this is a psychological portrait in the way that you would. It's not about torment or the things that I've done wrong. It's about surviving. It's about surviving things that happen to you. And and his disillusionment in the end is he blames God for his misfortune.
Yeah. Because there's that line, isn't there, probably about halfway through, where it says that Mendel Singer examined his conscience for grave sins and couldn't find any. No, he didn't do anything really wrong, but yet life keeps throwing, or God keeps throwing, these tests, these afflictions, these sufferings at him, and he's tested to the very brink.
I wonder, Samantha, could you read us the first few paragraphs? Normally we would read the blurb on the back of the book, but actually I think it's almost more useful just to hear the setup of the story, because it has have a fable-like quality, like a lot of Roth does.
Many years ago, they lived in Sukhno in Russia, a man named Mendel Singer. He was pious, God-fearing and ordinary, an entirely commonplace Jew. He practiced the simple profession of a teacher. In his house, which was merely a roomy kitchen, he instructed children in the knowledge of the Bible. He taught with honourable zeal and without notable success. Hundreds of thousands before him had lived and taught as he did. As insignificant as his nature was his pale face. A full beard of ordinary black framed it. The mouth was hidden by the beard. The eyes were large, black, dull and half veiled by heavy lids. On the head sat a cap of black silk rep, a stuff out of which unfashionable and cheap cravats are sometimes made. His body was stuck into the customary half-long Jewish kaftan of the country, the skirts of which flapped when Mendel Singer hurried through the street and struck with a hard, regular tack like the beat of wings against the shafts of his high leather boots. Singer seemed to have little time and a lot of pressing engagements. True, his life was always hard and at times even a torment to him. A wife and three children had to be clothed and fed. She was carrying a fourth. God had given fertility to his loins, equanimity to his heart, and poverty to his hands. They had no gold to weigh and no bank notes to count. Nevertheless, his life flowed along like a poor little brook between bare banks. Every morning, Mendel thanked God for his sleeping, for his awakening, and for the dawning day. When the sun went down, he said his prayers once again. When the first stars began to sparkle, he prayed for the third time, and before he laid himself down to sleep, he whispered a hurried prayer with tired but zealous lips. His sleep was dreamless, his conscience was pure, his soul was chaste. He had nothing to regret and he coveted nothing.
And that is such a brilliant setup, because of all the awful things that are going to happen to him. Which he does. I mean, this is a thing about this, Kieran. I don't want to give the ending away.
Yeah.
It's very hard to talk about this book.
It is.
And not talk about the ending. But I'm going to say that so much of what happens to Mendel Singer is arbitrary, as so much of what happens to Job in the book of Job in the Bible is arbitrary, because bad stuff happens. The ending, it seems to me, is also deliberately arbitrary. It's unearned, right? And so if we read the ending and we derive certain emotions from it, personally, I think that's sort of missing the point. I think it's quite a high-risk strategy to take, because you're pushing certain narrative buttons that you're in the knowledge that a normal reader will respond to them in a particular way. But I felt it's all part of the arbitrariness of bad things happen or good things happen, or events take place. What it struck me, Kieran, is the book of Job in the Bible is about a spiritual issue. Joseph Roth's book of Job is about how you respond to those things culturally, not spiritually.
It's interesting. Yeah.
And I wondered if you could just tell us, how does Job fit in with Roth's other novels? In what way is it not like the other novels?
Well, again, without wanting to say anything about the ending, it's the ending is not like many of his other novels, particularly the earlier ones, which time and again, the 1920s novels, where he keeps going back to the same situation, which is soldiers returning from the First World War and attempting to fit back into post-war society and finding that it can't quite accommodate them and they can't fit back into it. Most of those books end with these characters adrift. There's no great resolution, and that's the point. It's that these people have been kind of spat out by society and no longer really have a place. Whereas with Job, we do have a resolution, and it does move on at the end in a way that we find satisfying and I don't want to say more than that. But
is it the most? Is Job the most embedded in a particular kind of traditional Jewish culture compared with Roth's other novels?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, it's described as his most Jewish novel, and it is the first one where he really goes back to the world that he grew up in, which is, I think, almost entirely because of the way in which he wanted to retreat from the world at that time. The writing of this book, the context to it is Friedel, his wife, succumbing to schizophrenia, his world becoming intolerable, his presence becoming absolutely excruciating. And whereas the 1920s novels were these Heimkehrer Romane, they were known as like homecomers, novels about returning soldiers, they're like holding a mirror up to Weimar society. Whereas this book is more like a painting of the past. It goes back. I think the first three words of the book are actually hugely telling because he says many years ago. And we think, well, okay, it sounds like he's telling a fable, but actually it's not many years ago. What it is someone writing at the end of the 20s, 1930, about something that happened about 20 plus years ago, before the First World War. And what's implicit in that is that the First World War was a kind of temporal rupture, really. It was a complete chasm, which for Roth, when he's the other side of it, the world before, the prelapsarian world, seems utterly distinct and beyond reach. And because of the way it fell for him, coinciding pretty much with his transition from adolescence to adulthood, it's a really neat and distinct division between childhood and adulthood. And his childhood lies on the far side of the First World War, looking back. It's a childhood spent under the Habsburg monarchy, which collapses at the end of the war. And so really quite neatly, what seems to him like a relatively idyllic upbringing, obviously it didn't seem so much at the time, but in the late 1920s, in nostalgic hindsight it did, seems like somewhere that he would wish to retreat to when the present becomes so painful. So he starts writing really from Job onwards about his past, about the world he grew up under, and he starts writing in richer, more poignant, more lyrical prose.
I fell in love with a different Roth, I think. I fell in love with the kind of, you know, urbane, sophisticated, scrappy, messy kind of, you know, the journalist writing his books on the fly out of hotel rooms while trying to deal with his kind of, you know, crazy, not yet institutionalized wife and going out drinking all night. And, you know, the angry Roth, angry about what's happening in Europe and furious that no one was listening to him. I mean, his absolute rage of his journalism. I mean, absolutely just, why is no one listening? This is going to happen. He knew. I mean, I just feel like Roth knew, you know, obviously we read him with hindsight, but he knew. I mean, he really could see it all coming. And, you know, and I feel like you then go to Job and it's this kind of very beautiful, perfect novel, as we've all said. I mean, it's beautifully structured, it's perfect, and it's about this world in which everyone has a place and everyone sort of knows their place, and people who come out of the place of the shuttle, you know, it's not really a good idea, you know, it might work out in the end, but it's not really a good idea, you know, you should stay in your sort of place. No one expects to really live a larger life or a messier life or fight anything or. And I don't know. I mean, I suppose I wanted the kind of compulsive kind of storyteller, liar, drinker, writing all night, drinking all day. You know, I think this is a nostalgic look at what it was like in the shtetl, because actually, I'm going to tell you a terrible Jewish joke that my rabbi told me. Forgive me. I'm just ask forgiveness in advance.
It's fine. It's Friday night. Come on.
Come on. Okay, so my rabbi told me this joke, and I love this joke. I put it into four plays. It always gets cut. So Moshe is drowning in the river, and he's drowning, and he prays to God. He said, I've been a good man all my life. Save me, save me. And a branch goes by, and he thinks, shall I grab it? No, I'm not going to, because God is going to save me. A boat goes by. Do you want to come on? No problem. You know, God save me. Hang on. A big, like, massive ship comes by. They put down a ladder. They're like, jump up. We're going to get you to the site. No, it's fine. And then he drowns and he goes to heaven and he says to God, why didn't you save me? And God says, I sent a branch, I sent a boat, and I sent a fuck off big ship with a ladder. You've got to help yourself. And I feel the idea of Orthodox Judaism as being entirely based on faith and on just doing, you know, just going down the same old tracks feels to me very nostalgic and not really, not how anyone actually doing it actually feels about it. I could be wrong.
One of the really odd things about Job, and it connects back to the Holy Drinker book as well, I think, is you think it's going to be about a man whose simple faith is rewarded. And it's true that there is, without giving too much away, there is clearly is a reward in this book. But it doesn't seem to me to have anything to do with Mendel's faith. His faith has sort of left him. And that's fascinating to me. And that does connect to me with that, the kind of, you're talking about arbitrariness, the arbitrariness in the legend of the Holy Drinker, where the miracle is the man who gives him the money and enables him to. And it has a similar kind of weird religious dimension, although it's Catholic by this stage. So I think, Kieran, am I right in thinking he did convert to Catholicism?
Well, there's a question mark over that. Some people think that he did, and some were adamant that he didn't. Some of his Catholic friends tried to claim him for Catholicism. Some of his Jewish friends, you know, said that no, he never converted. And it's even said that he had two funerals, one Catholic and one Jewish.
I heard that there was one funeral and then a bunch of people on the other side of the fence shouting Jewish prayers over the
top. There was a kind of dust up at his funeral.
Which is a
bad
story.
Is there? I know, it's true. A very good story.
Is there a dust up at his funeral, Kieran? You
well, there was an argument. There were people complaining. I mean, it sounds quite chaotic, really, and absolutely emblematic of his life, really.
And did he disavow this novel? Have I got that right? He sent a copy to Stefan Zweig, is that
That's
right?
That's right. Before it even came out, he was tired of it. The book came out in October 1930. There's a letter from late September 1930 where he says words to the effect of, I'm done with it. I'm tired of it, or maybe I'm just tired, I think is how he puts it. He was never one for rereading his work, going back to it. You know, once it was done, it was done, and he moved on.
And he wrote so fast and on the backs of fag packets and so randomly in cafes that we don't actually know, do we, when all the novels were published or when they were written.
They're chaotic because he's writing sometimes two or three at once. Job, for example, he was writing, then he put it aside because, this is quite funny, early 1930, he had signed a contract with a right-wing Catholic conservative and anti-Semitic Nazi-owned newspaper called the Münchner Neuesten Nachrichten, I think it was. And this was at a time when he'd kind of fallen out with the Frankfurter Zeitung, which was the great liberal newspaper of Weimar Germany. So he took this kind of right-wing lowbrow paper's dollar or Deutschmark, and as part of the deal with them, it was that he had to write them a novel for serialization. He had a one-year deal. About 3 weeks from the end of that deal, the newspaper reminded him that he was meant to be delivering a novel to them. And so he sidelines Job and then frantically starts writing this other novel, drinking even more than ever. And to remind himself that he had to get it done quickly, he started scribbling on the manuscript, must complete novel in 3 weeks, must complete novel in 3 weeks, where he completes the novel.
Wow.
And yeah, he did write quickly, but to be fair, he wrote best when he wrote at a reasonable pace. His best books are the ones he took time on.
Is that true of Radetzky March?
I think so. Yeah, he took his time over that one, and it's, you know, and it shows. But he scoops up the manuscript for this novel for the right wing paper, including the pages which said must write novel in 3 weeks, posts them off to Munich, and the editors of this paper were aghast and did not want to publish the novel that had been hammered out in 3 weeks. And his relationship with that newspaper ended fairly rapidly after that. And then he went back to the Frankfurter Zeitung. But that's a roundabout way of answering your question. Job, shall I read this? Okay. So, and this is, it's a nice example of the kind of pastoral way that he wrote about the land, the kind of Galician rural landscape that he grew up in. The young sickle moon was already spreading a strong silver light. Faithfully accompanied by the brightest star of the heavens, she sailed through the night. Sometimes the dogs howled and frightened Mendel. They tore at the peace of the earth and increased Mendelsinger's unrest. Although he was only 5 minutes away from the houses of the town, he seemed to himself infinitely distant from the inhabited world of the Jews, indescribably alone, threatened by dangers, and yet incapable of going back. He turned northward. There breathed the dark forest. To the right, the swamp, with a few isolated silvery willows stretched away for many versts. To the left lay fields under opal veils. Sometimes Mendel thought he heard human sounds coming from an uncertain direction. He heard familiar voices, and it almost seemed to him as though he understood what they said. Then he remembered that he had heard them long ago, that he was listening to an echo which had long been waiting in his memory. Suddenly there was a rustling to the left in the wheat, although no wind stirred. The rustling seemed closer. Now Mendel could also see how the man-high ears of wheat moved. Something must be slinking amongst them. A human being, a huge animal, perhaps a monster. It would have been well to run away, but Mendel waited and prepared for death. A peasant or a soldier would now emerge from the grain, accuse Mendel of theft, and beat him then and there, stone him, perhaps. Or it might be a tramp, a murderer, a criminal, who would not wish to be seen or heard. Almighty God, whispered Mendel. Then he heard voices. There were two of them, who passed through the grain. And that it was not one quieted the Jew. Although he said to himself that there might well be two murderers. No, they were not murderers, but lovers. A girl's voice spoke. A man laughed. Even lovers could be dangerous. There were many cases where a man had become furious when he caught a witness of his love affair. Soon they must emerge from the field. Mendelsinger overcame his terrified disgust of snakes and softly lay down, his eyes turned towards the wheat. Then the years parted. The man emerged first, a man in uniform. A soldier in a dark blue cap, booted and spurred, the metal shining and clinking softly. Behind him, a yellow shawl gleamed, a yellow shawl, a yellow shawl. A voice arose, the voice of the girl. The soldier turned, laid his arm about her shoulders. Now the shawl parted. The soldier went behind the girl. His hands held her breasts. She sank back against him. And we know from the yellow shawl that that's his daughter, Miriam, who wears a yellow shawl. So this is his daughter, Miriam, going with a Cossack. Miriam, it turns out, actually has several Cossack lovers from the local barracks. One of Mendel's sons, Jonas, wants to join the Cossack army as well. So I think between the two, these kind of strike at the parameters of Mendel's existence because they're like the brutal symbols of assimilation that shake his world. Sex and the military, one creates new life, the other deals in death.
It's very peculiar for me to praise Roth as a stylist when the style changes significantly from book to book. But one of the things that I absolutely loved about Job. Job is one of my favourite books that we've done on Backlisted for quite a long time. And I must say, the reason why I like it so much is it's packed. I thought to myself that this is packed with brilliant sentences. Sentences, right, of what you want. I mean, you want them arranged in a pleasing order, by of course. But in terms of the bit that you just read, the precision of the and plainness of the language is such an incredibly difficult thing to pull off. Yeah, I found it incredibly powerful.
That sense, very powerful. That sense of about to end, that, of almost coming to the end of things. The other brilliant thing he does, very in the three very different books I've read, and Job in particular, is you do not know. You have a hunch where it's going to end up, but you could not predict the way he takes you there. And that's why he's so good at a sentence by sentence level. The way he builds the story,
yes, is
right to the very end. I read three times the last five pages of this novel to try and see if I could figure out what was happening. And it's still mysterious.
Before we go, because we've nearly run out of time, for goodness sake, we've got one more version of the Radetzky March to squeeze in. Before we hear that, I know, Samantha, yes, you wanted to read a bit of the journalism, and the journalism has all these qualities of its own. It is extraordinary in its own right, quite apart from the fiction. So it might be nice to hear that before we go.
So this is 1937. Roth is in Paris. He had been living in a hotel called the Hotel Foyot. And, I mean, everything ends in Roth. The hotel gets demolished, right? So he's, yeah, you know, I mean, he's lost his empire, he's lost his family, he's lost his wife. And then he gets to Paris and he's found the hotel and gets demolished. And, you know, but what I sort of love about it is that instead of kind of going off to drown his sorrows, he sits in the bistro opposite and writes about it, and then, you know, sells that piece to a paper for money. Yeah. He has a brilliant piece of writing. I mean, this is a little bit about it. So he'd seen three of the walls reduced to rubble, and then there's the fourth is still visible, on which I could still see the wallpaper in my room, which was sky blue with a fine gold pattern. Then yesterday they put up a scaffolding against the wall and two workers climbed up on it. With pickaxe and sledgehammer, they attacked my wallpaper, my wall. And then, when it was reeling and decrepit, the men tied ropes around the wall was to be put to death. The workers climbed down, dismantling the scaffolding as they went. The two ends of the rope hung down on either side of the wall. Each man took hold of one end and pulled, and with a crash, the wall came down. Everything was obscured by a dense white cloud of plaster dust and mortar. From it emerged, all coated in white dust like great millers who grind stones, the two men. They made straight for me. The younger one gestures back over his shoulder with his thumb and says, "It's gone now, your wall." They have a drink together. The workers were demolition men. Knocking things down was their job. They would never think of building anything. And quite right too, they said. Everyone does the job they do and gets paid the going rate. And this man here is the king of the demolition men, said the younger man. The older one smiled. That's how cheerful the destroyers were. And I with them. Now I'm sitting, facing the vacant lot and hearing the hours go by. You lose one home after another. It doesn't even frighten me anymore. And that's the most desolate thing of all. And I just think it's that sudden left turn. You know, you're laughing. Yeah. He's boozing, yeah, with a demolition,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
And you sort of go, this man, he's been made homeless again and again and again. And he's sort of laughing at this thing. You know, he sees his wallpaper, you know, being bulldozed. And then suddenly he just pulls you back into what it actually is actually going on in his heart.
It's so fascinating.
It's Backlisted, everybody. Read the novels. Yeah. Read the journalism.
I can't wait for the biography, Kieran.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Have you got must finish in 3 weeks written?
Yeah. Yes.
Because if not, why not?
I'm going to write it up on my wall in front of my desk.
Listen, everybody, that is an incredible 303 Acid House version of the Radetzky March. If you subscribe to our Patreon, I'll be playing all 1.5 minutes of that on the next episode of Not Listed.
Not if I can help it.
Yeah, I don't.
Right, even miracles have an end to them. Huge thanks to Kieran and Sam for leading us through the rich complexity of Roth's life and works. And to Nikki for weaving our wanderings into a rich and comforting whole, and to Unbound for the barley soup and candles.
You can download all 130 previous episodes, plus follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website at backlisted.fm. And we're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter and Facebook
and now in sound and pictures on Instagram too.
You can also show your love directly by supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted. We aim to survive without any paid for advertising, so your generosity helps us do that. All patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early, and for a fistful of rubles, they get two extra lot listeds a month in our cabin on the edge of town, where we sit in the sunshine, listen to frogs, play songs, read books, and talk to the moon.
Who wouldn't want to? Who wouldn't want to subsidise that? Lot listeners also get to hear their names read out on the show as a mark of our thanks and appreciation. And this week's batch of names are
Jonathan Morgan, Anne Phillips, Lynn Russell, Vicky van der Luet, Connor, Luke Turner, former guest, thank you, Luke,
Howard Fairbrass, Mark Hazel, Claire Rose, Mark Ruff, Bridget Loughhead, and Thomas Cotter. Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, Samantha. Kieran, I asked you when we were preparing this episode if there was a piece of music that you felt would be appropriate. You didn't say, do you have an acid house version of the Radetzky March that you could squeeze in?
I didn't, and I don't know why it didn't occur to me.
But in marked contrast, you suggested this beautiful, beautiful piece of music. Do you want to say something about the song, and then I'll introduce who's singing it?
Yeah, so this is a song that's one of Roth's oldest friends, a fellow writer called Soma Morgenstern, played him in his kind of final weeks or months, I think. And Roth found it incredibly moving. It's a song called Doodler, and it's a song of kind of the old Eastern Jewish world, really. And in Soma Morgenstern's memoir about his friendship with Roth, he describes playing this song and the song moving Roth to tears because it reminded him of the old world that they had both grown up in and had both left behind.
Well, here is a recording from exactly 100 years ago. This was recorded in 1921 and you're going to hear the voice of Mordecai Hirschman, the Vilna state singer. This was recorded while Joseph Roth was alive. Thanks for listening, everybody. Yeah,
thank you, everybody. See you in a fortnight.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.